Hello, and welcome to Studio Sessions, the big red and shiny podcast where we talk with artists about the ideas, inspiration, and processes that go into their work. I'm your host, Matt Kuhlman, and today I'll be speaking with Andrea Evans. Andrea earned a BFA in painting from Arizona State University in 2004, and is a 2009 MFA graduate from the School of the Museum of Fine Arts in Boston. Her work ranges between drawing, painting, and performance, and typically uses her body as a reference point in each piece. She often draws herself in poses taken from her performance-based pieces that involve wearing articles and impractical clothing, such as a sweater with no head hole or a pair of socks joined together at the toes. Her husband, Kirk Snow, also a working artist, has recently become a part of these pieces and performances. Join me as she discusses her thoughts and experiences that inform her work. Hi, how are you doing today?
I'm good, how are you?
Thanks for being here. Going to talk a little bit about some of the work that you've been doing recently mm-hmm. and even before that. But first, just tell us a little bit about your background mm-hmm. and how you got to where you are today.
Sure. I grew up in Arizona. I spent the first 20-some years of my life out there and got into art making at a pretty early age through my obsession with horses. Mm-hmm. And so I did a lot of horse drawings growing up. But ended up, you know, sort of in high school having this discovery that this was something that I could actually do, that this is something I could, that an artist is something that I could be, and, went to Arizona State for undergrad and studied painting there. Took some time off after school and was involved in some of the different galleries that are in the Phoenix art scene, and including a cooperative art gallery called iLounge, and then came out to Boston to go to grad school at the Museum School, and I've been here since then.
Mm-hmm. So, how did you hear about that school?
The Museum School?
Yeah. Or what drew you to that as opposed to staying in the region?
Yeah, I mean, I knew that I wanted to go somewhere different, having spent, you know, my whole life in Arizona, and I'd always been really interested in the East Coast. My grandparents were from Pennsylvania, and so it just seemed very, you know, very far away and very different than what I'd grown up with. And mm-hmm. One of the things that really attracted me to the Museum School, which is sort of different than what it has now, but it was a 3-year program where you do all of your classes in the first 2 years, and then the third year you basically just focus on putting together your thesis show. And coming from ASU, most of the grad students I knew there were there for maybe 3 or 4 years. And so going to school for just 2 years didn't seem like a lot of time for me. So, mm-hmm. And I liked, you know, the work that was coming out of the school, the size of the school, and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. So,
what kind of transformation in your work did you mm-hmm. see through that time?
Mm-hmm. Definitely, I mean, I think that the transformation came in a lot of different ways. One was sort of the materials that I was using. Like, I was trained as a painter, was making a lot of these sort of large-scale, really colorful, figurative paintings with a lot of pattern and sort of decoration. And I just came out here and, you know, just felt like I didn't want to keep making the same kinds of paintings, and I couldn't find a way in painting that I really wanted to work that felt new and different. And so I started working a lot more in drawing, and the Museum School has a really interdisciplinary program, and so you're encouraged to take classes in performance and video and all this stuff. So I really started branching out a lot, and that I think informed the way that my work developed, especially with work and performance. Even though I do some performance work, but I think my work is really informed a lot by performance.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, drawing has been definitely sort of my major, my main sort of the foundation of my practice right now. And then in terms of sort of the ideas in my work, I was really started looking back at Arizona and thinking about growing up there, thinking about the landscape there. And that really influenced the work I did for my thesis, which had a lot to do with my relationship to the desert landscape, ideas about memory, sort of how we kind of construct these ideas of place.
Mm-hmm.
And while I've got kind of gotten away from that, it still has really driven a lot of the way I've been thinking about my work.
Mm-hmm. And even outside of the school environment,
mm-hmm.
how did you find it being in such a different art scene
mm-hmm.
in Boston as opposed to Arizona, which
mm-hmm.
I lived in New Mexico briefly,
uh-huh.
and I know how prevalent the kind of commercial Southwest art scene
yeah.
is and
yeah.
how that can kind of dominate everything.
Yeah, that's definitely very present, although I think that because, you know, it doesn't, rent is so much cheaper and stuff there, there's a lot of possibilities for artists to sort of start their own thing in Phoenix
mm-hmm.
and other areas. So there was, you know, while there is that sort of Southwestern aspect, I think that there were also a lot of, you know, young artists who were looking to start something new,
mm-hmm.
which I think is a little bit harder out here because just everything's so much more expensive. But I think, you know, the proximity to New York definitely feels really different out here. There's still some of that kind of changeover with gallery spaces and stuff, but it's so great to have, you know, some of the cultural institutions, like all the museums, all of the different schools that are here. There's just a lot. I mean, at any point in time, you could go see, you know, a number of interesting shows.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that that's definitely a huge benefit being out here.
And going back to, you started talking about some of your most recent work
mm-hmm.
for your MFA. Can you describe a little bit of what you were doing in it? I've seen
mm-hmm.
some images,
yeah.
but I'm not sure of the chronology of the pieces that I saw.
So. Yeah, yeah. And I keep talking about that work because I think it really affects what I'm doing now. But it's funny to think that now it's been a couple of years even since I did that body of work. But
mm-hmm.
For those pieces, and this has been similar to how I've been working even in kind of the current work that I've been making, has a lot to do with particular places. So going out into different locations, I've been really interested in different kinds of landscape. And in that work, it was sort of the desert landscape outside of Phoenix. And more recently, it's been sort of more forested landscape in New England and Canada and Alaska. And my work definitely uses photography a lot. So there's kind of this performative element of being out in the landscape and then documenting that through photography. And then those images get reworked into drawings. And I sort of see them as becoming, like, constructed again. Like,
mm-hmm.
reconstructed, rebuilt, and but also really mediated from that original experience. So in a lot of cases, I use myself as sort of a figure in the landscape, and in other cases also bring in my partner, my husband Kirk, and sort of explore our relationship to one another and our relationship to different spaces and places. So kind of through some of these ambiguous interactions with objects within the space or trees or different kinds of natural elements that kind of become a sort of landmark
mm-hmm.
in the space.
So in your imagery,
mm-hmm.
are you working exclusively with your own photography, or do you
yeah.
use other sources?
No, it's pretty much all of my own photography. And I think that that kind of comes back to, I mean, for me, it's really important to sort of have the actual experience in the
mm-hmm.
space. And
so did you actually go to Alaska?
Mm-hmm.
What was that like?
Yeah, I did a residency at the Homestead AK, a sort of emerging artist residency a couple hours from Anchorage, and it was really incredible, and the landscape there is unlike anything else that I've
not
ever
much
seen.
Else up there, I suppose.
No, it's so open. I was out there in the summer, and so not only was the space totally vast, but time was really weird because it was almost 24 hours of daylight. So it was almost like entering into this entirely different world where, you know, you're sort of out in nature or whatever, and I actually felt like something could kill me, you know, if I wasn't careful. We saw bears and there was
this. Did you
have
any close encounters with animals?
There were some moose on the property that we saw, And one of them sort of inhabited part of the space, and we followed the trail that it kind of wove throughout the property. And then we were out fishing, like, in the middle of the night one night, and saw a bear out on a sandbar in the river. And that was really scary. It was sort of like a young grizzly bear. And even though it was really far away,
Those are both very aggressive animals.
I was kind of terrified. I mean, but in a good way, though, I think. I mean, clearly, obviously nothing happened, and we weren't bothering either of them. But I don't know. I think that we often forget that. I think we often have these ideas that we have so much control over our lives, or especially living in the city. I mean, I'm sure it's way more likely that you would die in a car accident than get eaten by a bear, but there's something about, like, the idea of being able to be eaten by something.
I don't know. I would imagine it'd be much more horrific to be eaten.
Yeah, probably.
To get hit by a car.
I think that's probably the scariest thing I can think of.
So how did you find the wilderness in Alaska compared to the wilderness of the desert? Because that can also be a very dangerous place.
Definitely. I mean, I think the forests are really different. I mean, in the desert, you can see distances much differently.
Mm-hmm.
That you can see a lot farther. I mean, there's mountains too, obviously, but and then in Alaska, there is, you know, in both places, I think there's, you know, you do see people living out in more, like, remote areas. But they can kind of do different things to you, I guess. Yeah, so I think that they're definitely similar in many ways, even though they look so, like, drastically different.
Mm-hmm. And aside from the element of danger, what else are you taking away from these places that you use in your work?
I mean, I think I've been thinking a lot lately about sort of our relationship to the natural world, and I've been doing some reading about just kind of, like, how we define, like, what is nature, what is natural, and what is, like, artificial, and there's sort of this whole discussion about that I think Bill McKibben sort of talked about, and the end of nature, that, like, basically we have touched, like, because of climate change and everything else, there's nothing, like, nothing in the natural world that has been untouched by humans.
Mm-hmm.
And so sort of really interested in these ideas about how each of us defines nature for ourselves, like, what it is that we hope to find in being out in nature, like, how we relate to it. I mean, this, I feel like it's such a complex, there's sort of all of these different, it's not clear cut, you know, there's,
mm-hmm.
it's a very complex relationship, and it's something that I've been really interested in investigating in my work lately, sort of like, are we separate, are we part of nature, same thing with, like, human relationships, you know, like, no matter how close you might be to someone, there's always this division, there's always this gap between you and this other person, and that you can really never cross that.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm interested in sort of constantly trying to do that, trying to bridge the gap, or trying to make a connection, or looking at different ways to sort of, just looking at different ways to try and make connections with other things.
Describe some specific projects where you've explored those areas.
Yeah, I've done a number of drawings and some related performances and some things like that where, again, with my husband Kirk, I started working with him because previously I was working a lot just with myself, and he was this way to, like, sort of duplicate myself but also talk about, like, you know, have another figure there, have this, like, push and pull between two bodies rather than one.
Mm-hmm.
And so I've done a series of pieces with him where we are wearing the same matching plaid shirt, and then using this as a kind of, like, second skin to bring our bodies together, in some cases, like, wrapping ourselves around a tree, you know, having this tree sort of appear like it's growing up between us or it's separating us, you know, is it being invited into the relationship or is it like something that's in the way? So I've done a series of drawings using that kind of imagery, again, taken from photographs that were sort of staged. Another sort of grouping of pieces where we are sort of wearing the same shirt and trying to kind of like inhabit that together, you know, negotiate that kind of close space.
Mm-hmm.
And then I've also been working on a series of drawings where, without any figurative element, but where the figure, sort of an action from the figure is implied. And so last summer we spent some time in Nova Scotia and I was really struck by these. There was this sort of path through the trees to get down to the beach in this part of Cape Breton near where we were staying. And there are these trees that were spray painted, like these bright red marks to let you know, like, this is the path, this is how you get there. And I was really interested in one sort of formal, on the formal element side, just like how striking it was to see this mark in the natural world, you know, this like this thing that didn't
belong
there.
It'd be very out of place out there.
So. Yeah, totally. But then also thinking about like how, you know, I've lost all the skills to like find my way, you know, in nature. You know, I do some hiking, but you know, I know that there are people that have those skills to navigate their way through the natural world, but.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I need a mark there to tell me where to go. And this idea of this path that was made and all the people have passed down, who have passed through this, you know, use these markers to find their way and the way that that's going to still be there after, you know, I've left. Just sort of really interested in this idea of a marker and this this reflection of a human action or many different kinds of human actions just sort of being left there.
Mm-hmm.
So this, like, this tree sort of being pulled from the forest and just looked at as a kind of landmark in a way. So I've been working on a series of these trees and they're really like removed from the particular place that they are. It's just a single tree or a grouping of trees that are pulled out. Because I'm really interested in that kind of ambiguous space.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's where, you know, even though I'm working a lot with photographs, that's where the drawing becomes really important to me because it's removing from that moment, it's removing it from that particular space and time, and it still has a connection to that, but sort of all of those other details are left out, and, you know, sort of the main thing is, the main subject matter is there and kind of left a little stranded, I think, in a way.
How large are some of these works?
The tree drawings have been around 30 inches by... You know, some are narrow, more like 20 inches or maybe 3 feet wide. And then some of the other pieces I've been doing have been a little bit smaller, more like some of the just the figurative pieces are more like 11 by 14 or something.
Mm-hmm.
Probably the biggest pieces I did were the desert series from my thesis show, and they were more like 40 by 50 or something, but
mm-hmm.
just a lot of white space.
Yeah.
So.
Is there any reason why you decided to go a little bit smaller then, I guess, because of dealing with like a kind of environmental
mm-hmm.
subject like that,
mm-hmm.
there could be the option of going really large scale to be immersive or
yeah.
more intimate, I suppose.
Yeah, I mean, I think for me, having the white space in a way and thinking about that kind of expanding out much larger, you know, whenever my work is framed, it's always framed in white frames generally, so
mm-hmm.
you know, generally shown on a white wall, so I sort of see them as that white blank space expanding larger than the piece itself.
Yeah, I guess on the in that situation
mm-hmm.
it'd be a continuation of the wall in
yeah
a sense, so.
And I think I've just started working this scale, you know, again, when I was making paintings, a lot of times the figures were around life size, and it is something that I think about, but I've been pretty happy working this scale where, because the work is so intricate and so detailed, I mean, a lot of times the work doesn't reproduce well, you can't really see it from a distance very well, and
mm-hmm.
so I want it to really pull you in. so that there's kind of a different experience viewing it from far away and then up close. So I think I like that there is this kind of tactile quality. There's like a I don't know, a lot of stuff is maybe like around the sides of your head or a little bit bigger, so to kind of pull you in to really look closely. But in a lot of other ways, I think about like the scale of the work also existing through the series of the work too, because almost in all the pieces that I do, they exist as a series, and so mm-hmm. I think about them spatially in terms of like installation or kind of continuing around the space.
So I guess if you had a whole show of these tree drawings, mm-hmm. it'd be kind of like walking through a forest and seeing small glimpses of it here and there.
I think so. I was thinking about that idea of like, you know, following these markers, like physically sort of following a path, and then sort of having the drawings themselves being a kind of like marker that you move from one to the next as well.
Mm. And going back to some of the figurative work you mm-hmm. did with your husband, those almost look like documentary photos of performances, mm-hmm. and you said that they can be mm-hmm. somewhat performative, but do they mostly exist as the drawing itself?
Yeah, I usually, like, that's always something that I'm thinking about, sort of why in one case is something a performance and why in another case does it become a drawing.
Mm-hmm. Or I guess, would you ever, like, replicate the performance mm-hmm. again in some kind of scenario?
I think I generally try to keep them a little bit separate, keep the imagery sort of separate, so that it's sort of more specific. You know, this kind of imagery is, it may be kind of come out of a performative action, but the end result is intended to be a drawing.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas in other pieces, you know, the whole thing may just be a performance piece. And so I think that I try to kind of separate them. Like, is it important for that action to be seen and experienced by other people? Or is it important for it to be sort of removed and mediated and perhaps be like a little bit more metaphorical through mm-hmm. the drawings? So they definitely relate to one another, but it's, you know, I wouldn't generally draw from a performance.
Okay.
If that, like, from performance documentation that was strictly as a performance. But I did do some pieces that were, I mean, definitely related, where after doing this series of drawings of the desert landscape, where I was a figure in that landscape and I had knitted this headless sweater and was wearing this in the desert, and so I had a series of photos that I took out in the desert
mm-hmm.
and made a bunch of drawings based upon them. And then about a year later, I did do a performance wearing the sweater.
Mm-hmm.
But it was sort of like, in the drawings, it was a lot about kind of what the desert was standing in for me, like sort of the desert as an idea of home, how my ideas about the desert kind of evolved and became idealized in living far away from it. Whereas in the performance, it was sort of trying to bring these elements, sort of stand-ins for the desert, into the gallery space,
mm-hmm.
and trying to do, basically, I had these rocks that were shipped from Arizona by my parents from like a Home Depot.
Okay, very, very authentic.
Yeah, so they're sort of, you know, desert landscaping rocks, and then I like attempted to plant this cactus in the rocks to sort of construct a kind of substitute for the desert landscape
mm-hmm.
in the gallery space. So they're definitely relate. Those are probably the pieces that are most related in terms of, you know, drawing and performance, but still kind of separate things happening.
Mm-hmm. And in your drawings, there's a lot of articles of modified clothing,
mm-hmm.
especially when you're with Kirk and
mm-hmm.
wearing like a two-person shirt. Did you actually make all of these articles?
Yeah, I've done both. In some cases, I've sort of appropriated objects and used them kind of against their natural use. So, you know, taking a shirt and trying to wear it with two people, or taking a union suit and trying to like fit two people into it. But
mm-hmm.
then I also started incorporating some of my knitting into my work as well, and started constructing these absurd garments. So the double balaclava is based on a Red Cross, World War One Red Cross knitting pattern for like a balaclava, so your face is open but your head is warm. But I connected it, I made two and I connected them together, so two people wore them together, and you're sort of having this really close face-to-face relationship.
Are the faces facing each other?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah, and so there's
That'd be a little intense.
It is, and that was a really interesting piece, because when I made it, I was really just thinking about using it for drawing as an object to be worn by two figures to then make drawings based upon. But there was this like crazy thing that happened, that when you wore it with someone else, it was like really intense experience, and some people would take it off immediately because it felt completely claustrophobic, and other people, you know, really liked it, you know, and you have this weird, you can see what the other person looks like. You mean you're like breathing the same air, you know, and the other person looks totally beautiful because they're like framed by this green knitting. I mean, it's really weird and really interesting. And then
the image, it looks kind of like radiant rays shining away from their face.
And so then I became really interested in, you know, how this single object could then sort of be the center point for all of these different kinds of explorations, that there is something that happens in the performance that was different in wearing it that's different than what happens in the drawing, but that they could both sort of talk about similar things. And so I kind of go back and forth between making objects that are sort of strange and then using sort of found objects or particular like chosen objects, like the plaid shirts or striped shirts. Head is connected with someone else's head or something. Like, we did a performance at Mobius in Boston, Kirk and I, where we wore the double balaclava, the reverse double balaclava, where you can face out. And this was sort of based on the piece that Marina Abramović and Ule did, where they tied their hair together. And they were, I think, connected for like 17 hours. And this piece, we were only connected for a couple hours. But we were basically sort of audience members for other people's performances and sort of negotiating the space, sort of connected in that way.
And the first piece that got us started talking about this was, you said it was a headless sweater, and it's kind of like a cloak. It's like a Snuggie without a head hole. Where did the idea come? It was that the first piece that you did like that? The first wearable?
The first piece I did was the green balaclava. But yeah, this was the first. So this object was made for one person to wear, and it's basically a sweater that has no head. So where the head opening should be, the sweater just continues up and connects at the top. And I was thinking a lot about this when I was thinking about my relationship to the desert and thinking about my relationship to home. You know, I was just thinking a lot about how we construct certain memories, we construct our ideas about place, and that for me feels really internal, and it's not about seeing what's actually there, but sort of seeing something that you sort of imagine. And so I liked the idea of this object that would blind me, that I could wear out in the desert, but actually not see what's surrounding me. So there's kind of this break between perception and ideas about memory and sort of what you might see in your head. And so it both functions to blind you in a way, but also, you know, is about this act of being blind at the same time, I guess, if that makes sense.
And if I remember right, you make your drawings through not necessarily a just traditional graphite process. Can you explain a little bit how you make them?
Yeah, most of my drawings are silver point, and so I'm actually drawing with silver, sterling silver metal. And then there's usually some little bit of color that generally is either gouache or watercolor or sometimes acrylic. And this was a technique that a friend taught me when I was living in Arizona. He gave me a silver point tool and sort of showed me how to use it. And then I also took a class at the museum school called the Contemporary Icon, where we used a lot of these really traditional techniques. And that's when I really fell in love with it, because silver point has a quality that looks like graphite,
mm-hmm.
but it doesn't smudge. And over time, the silver tarnishes, and so it takes on a different kind of coloration,
mm-hmm.
depending on what it's exposed to in the atmosphere. But
so this is actually a very traditional process.
Yeah,
I'm not very familiar with
it. So it dates back to like the Renaissance, and it sort of started out, originally scribes used these different stylus, styli, I guess,
mm-hmm.
to inscribe in like clay or wax tablets. And then, and so they would be different metals, and that kind of reflected, you know, how wealthy the person that they worked for was.
Mm-hmm.
And so they were maybe made of gold or silver or things like that. And so then they started, using it as like a drawing or writing tool, preparing vellum or parchment with some kind of, you need some kind of ground, otherwise the silver won't make a mark.
Mm-hmm.
So if you think about how, if you have like a metal ruler or nail or something and it scratches the wall, like a painted wall, it'll make a metal mark. And basically that's little bits of the metal rubbing off on the surface. So you have to have
mm-hmm.
some kind of gesso down. And then as paper technology came, came around, you know, over to the West, different papers were then prepared with gessos, and silver point was used. So it was pretty popular, I think, early Renaissance, and then as, you know, other techniques or other materials were discovered, you know, graphite was discovered and stuff like that, those things kind of took over in terms of popularity.
Mm-hmm.
But silver points kind of come in and out of popularity, I think, with artists, and it's something that I've just totally fallen in love with.
Mm-hmm.
It's very precise. It doesn't really erase very well. I kind of think about it as like a combination of graphite and pen and ink. So
mm-hmm.
it's like super subtle and really delicate.
Yeah, it looks like you can get some really nice atmospheric
mm-hmm.
kind of tonalities.
Yeah, it's, you know, so it has a very really limited value range. You can't get super dark with it. And then I sand the tip of the silver in order to get kind of the point that I want. So it's a super, it goes a long way. Like I will use, you know, I've got a couple inches of silver and they'll probably last me, you know, a couple years.
Wow.
And it's just basically like jeweler's silver. And so, I mean, my materials are really simplified in a lot of ways. Like I use paper, I make my own silver point gesso that's made out of rabbit skin glue and zinc white. So that's, I stretch the paper and I gesso the paper and then cut it off of the stretcher bars and cut it down to whatever size I need and then work in the silver and then some, whatever kind of, you know, color that I want to incorporate as well.
Mm-hmm. Looking forward in the work that you're going to be doing
mm-hmm.
in the near future, will it be a direct continuation of the series that we're seeing here? Do you see some evolution that's coming soon?
Yeah, I've got, I'm continuing along with the sort of marker pieces, the tree marks, because I've got a couple more images that I want to work with, and I'm sort of looking at how I want that project to grow in different ways. I've been doing some sculptural work as well that's been related, actually bringing trees, or pieces of trees or logs or firewood and wrapping them or constructing different kinds of things, I don't know, alterations to them. And I'm interested in continuing with that, but I'm also about to start a new series of work. I have some images I took with my sister, she's 3 years younger than I am, and we've always been really close. She still lives in Arizona, and I've been really interested to continue sort of explorations of relationships between different people and working with her and sort of thinking about our relationship, even though we're technically adults now.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when we spend time together, it's really easy for us to fall back into like acting like we're 5 years old. And so
mm-hmm.
sort of interested in how those actions sort of playing and fighting what that looks like when it's happening through adult bodies rather than child bodies. So,
are you going to explore that through the drawing methods that you're doing, or more performative?
I think more through drawing. I was recently back in Arizona, and we took a bunch of pictures together, sort of playing and fighting and tickling each other and stuff like that. So I think that that's going to be the starting point anyways, and then kind of looking to see if there might be some performance pieces that could evolve out of that, or possibly using her as part of performance, I think could be really interesting. So I think I'm looking at sort of continuing along in similar ways, but having the work kind of grow through imagery and through my thinking about the work as well.
So. Very well. Thanks for talking with me, and we'll see you soon.
Well, thanks. It's been a lot of fun.
And that concludes this episode of Studio Sessions with our guest Andrea Evans. You can find her work online at andreasherylevans.com. You can also learn more about me at my website, mattkuhlman.com. If you'd like to support this program, you can send a donation through PayPal to studiosessionspodcast@gmail.com. Even if you only send $1, your donation helps guarantee that I can continue providing interviews with interesting artists for your listening pleasure. And of course, don't forget to visit bigredandshiny.com for future episodes, along with other high-quality arts and culture content. Thank you for listening, and see you next time on Studio Sessions.